The next matter, number 24-2127, Timmy Y. Wallace versus William Scott Pilliller. At this time, would counsel for the appellant please come to the podium and introduce himself on the record to begin?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name's Charles Allen Hope for petitioner Timmy Wallace. With me is attorney John Cuna. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
You may.
Thank you. Your Honors, this court is a habeas appeal from the denial of a habeas petition in the district court. The issue is whether the defendant's speedy trial right was denied by the state courts. The trial at issue, the delay that we allege triggers a speedy trial investigation, was 7.5 years from the time of the indictment to the time of the arraignment. We don't pursue any claims of additional delay between the arraignment and the actual trial.
Before the SJC, that was a different argument was made, right? At that time, the defendant was claiming the delay went back to 2000 rather than 2002. Is that right?
The SJC found that. The defendant didn't particularly make that argument, and he certainly didn't make that argument below.
Did he argue below that the delay started in 2002, that was the correct date?
The indictment is the date. Yes, I believe he did.
I wasn't
district court counsel, but I believe that was the argument before the district court.
Do you have a citation for that?
I do not, but I can find you one, Your Honor. The relevance of that question, of course, is that the SJC principal reason for it, looking at the way they balance the factors under the Barker test to find that the speedy trial was not violated, was that they said, well, Mr. Wallace was a fugitive for nearly as long as he was as the delay attributable to the Commonwealth, and therefore we're going to find that mitigates any damage from the delay the Commonwealth caused. Given that in our evaluation, the delay was actually noticeably shorter than the SJC.
Right, it's sort of a twofold problem, right? The miscalculation means the length of delay is calculated incorrectly by the SJC, but then that flows into the prejudice to the defendant, right? Because I think you would argue the SJC is misweighing, they're attributing too many years to the defendant, and so not accurately assessing the prejudice.
In multiple ways, Your Honor. We also say that they improperly attributed the delay between the arrest and the federal sentencing to the defendant, where we say that shouldn't be attributed to the defendant. That's attributable to the Commonwealth.
That point is a tricky legal question.
Well, that's attributable to the Commonwealth and excusable. We agree. We don't contest that it was reasonable of the SJC to say that period of delay was excused due to the Commonwealth's determination that the federal trial should go first. So we're not claiming that it's an unreasonable delay, but to the extent it was a delay, it was a delay that was on the Commonwealth. It was the Commonwealth's decision. My client had no ability to affect that decision one way or the other. There's no reasonable ground.
You're saying it should have been a neutral in the balancing test.
Yes, it was. So the Supreme Court identifies three kinds of delay. They identify extremely, and they say it's a spectrum, so these aren't explicitly category A, category B, category C, but they say there are improper delays, such as a bad faith attempt to damage Mr. Wallace's case. There are improper but not so bad delays, such as negligence, and we'll get negligence in more detail in a minute. And then there are excusable delays, of which the delay to the examples include a witness being sick, I think, and under which we would concede that it's reasonable for the SJC to have found that the waiting for the sentencing in the federal case was a reasonable delay within that framework. We do argue that it was inappropriate of the SJC to find that the further delay was mere negligence, and I'll get to that in a moment. There are two primary cases, Supreme Court cases, which are at issue here, Barker and Doggett. Barker lays out the four factors which are relevant. Doggett applies them to a particular case. I will begin with the analysis of Doggett here, because I think Qualledge is not technically indistinguishable from Mr. Wallace's case. It's clearly on all fours, and to the extent that an unreasonable decision includes one which fails to extend a precedent to an appropriate context, it's clear that the SJC unreasonably applied Doggett. The four factors are length of delay, prejudice to the defendant.
Let me interrupt you. Let's say I look at those four factors and I say, you know, the SJC got these wrong. These weigh far more heavily in favor of Mr. Wallace than the SJC thought. They made a mistake on each one of those for some of the reasons you articulated in your briefs. We still have that question of, was the result objectively unreasonable? What's your best argument that it was?
Well,
how are we to decide that question if we get past all these other hurdles?
Well, my first answer to that question, Your Honor, is the analysis comparing to Doggett. An unreasonable decision is one which improperly fails to apply a Supreme Court precedent. And in our position, they completely failed to apply Doggett. The length of delay is nearly identical. 7.5 years here to 8 years in Doggett. The length of time that Mr. Wallace was a fugitive, 2 years and 2 months, is nearly identical to the 2.5 years that Mr. Doggett was out of the country. There's no plausible difference between those for the court to apply.
Both cases were approximately 5 years of delay that are
attributable
to the government.
Yes, they call it nearly six in Doggett, I believe, but yeah. In terms of prejudice, the only prejudice in Doggett was the prejudice from the length of the delay that is presumed, because there's a presumption of prejudice from a delay because it's nearly impossible to prove one way or the other. In this case, Mr. Wallace clearly has that prejudice, but he also has the prejudice that there was a loss of concurrent sentencing time in this case of 4 years or more, where his sentence.
The ultimate sentence, it was a concurrent sentence?
The ultimate sentence was life with possibility of parole in 15 years, concurrent beginning as of the day of sentencing. So, had the trial taken place.
What concurrent does in that situation is does it thrust forward when you're parole eligible, because life is the backside of that.
Life is the backside. It's not affected, but the parole eligibility, had the trial taken place 4 years earlier, would have begun 4 years earlier.
So that's what it does for the defendant.
Yes, that's what it does for the defendant. So there was more prejudice here than there was in Doggett.
Okay.
With regard to the other two.
Just one more point on that.
Yes.
That I got from your brief, there was punitive or harder time in the federal system because
yes,
that
he
had an unresolved state charge. Is that the
yes,
position?
Yes, that is also our position.
So that's the prejudice.
Those are the prejudice, in addition to the prejudice that was present in Doggett of the damage to his case from the delay. The major distinguishing factor between this case and Doggett is that in Doggett, the defendant did not know that there were charges pending, according to the court found that the defendant did not know that there were charges pending, and the government had no idea where the defendant was.
That's a complicated part of the case for me. So in your situation, it's clear at least he knew that there was a murder situation.
He knew there was a
him.
Warrant.
Right.
He knew there was a warrant.
But he has to know there's an indictment, is your position.
He had no notice of the indictment, is our position. There's nothing in the record to show he had notice of the indictment. The Commonwealth relies on two incorrect statements in the federal court that he was indicted at the time of the federal crime, which he was not, and a notice that he received in July of 2009, 2 months before he was 3 months before he was brought in for his arraignment.
Well, the Commonwealth seems to be suggesting that because of this general awareness that he had something going on in state court, that he should have exerted or made some kind of effort to figure out what that was and press somehow speedy trial rights just based upon that knowledge alone.
Well, we've got a couple of responses to that, Your Honor. One is that without knowledge of an indictment, he had no federal speedy trial right to press. This court found in Rashad that a letter prior to indictment or any attempt to press speedy trial prior to indictment is not viable. Second, we would say that, yes, there is knowledge that something is going on in this case that is different from in Doggett. We concede that. But at the same time, different from in Doggett is that the government knew exactly where he was and how to get him. So there is knowledge on part of both parties that was not present in Doggett. That's a difference which makes this not strictly contrary to Doggett. But given that Barker is clear and unequivocal that defendant has no obligation to bring himself to trial, that's not his duty. The duty rests on the government. The government is required to be the one to bring them to trial. The fact that that knowledge was present on both sides can't be weighed to make this a case where the speedy trial right was not violated when it was violated in Doggett.
So you're saying that the SJC sort of implicit holding that the court can consider pre-indictment, even though there was no formal indictment, but information that the defendant knew about, perhaps, we should not be extending Doggett to suggest that once a defendant has some inkling that something is going on, that there should be an obligation on the defendant to start pressing.
Two things about that, Your Honor. One is that the SJC makes its decision under the state constitutional provision, which it says is analogous to the Sixth Amendment. But under the state constitutional amendment provision, time did start ticking at the complaint. That's when the state, at the complaint and issuance of the warrant in 2000. So that's the...
That puts a fly in the...
Well, no.
No, not for you, but I guess I'm just trying to... This is the part of the case I don't fully grasp. So the SJC is looking at it and saying, well, his speedy trial rights triggered from the complaint, which is he knows of the warrant. That means there's a complaint. So he knows. And then federally, because we start at the indictment and the evidence that he knows of the indictment is not clear, we'd say he doesn't know.
Yes, sir.
And then the problem is then that becomes either, I guess, a neutral factor or it just doesn't do anything, you'd say, because he doesn't know he's indicted. It's the Commonwealth knows he's indicted. They're not doing anything about it. And he, even though he knows of general complaint, he doesn't have an obligation to say, are you indicting me or not? And that's your point.
That's our point. Yes, Your Honor. Unless there are any further questions.
I want to go back to the question I asked you. So I said I'm really wrestling with this. What does objectively unreasonable mean? And I thought you said I have three answers to that. The first is this is just Doggett, which I understand those arguments. You've just made them.
Oh, yes. I certainly...
Do you have any other...
our argument in our brief for how puts out several the flaws in each of the SJC's argument and says that the SJC's arguments are unreasonable. And
take it as true. The SJC actually got it wrong on all four factors of Barker. Let's just assume that. But I sit here now and I say, yeah, okay, the things you say, let's just say take prejudice. You're right about those things. There was some prejudice here that the SJC did not account for. But if they had accounted for it, it might still be reasonable to say, you know what, that's still not enough prejudice to give a speedy trial remedy. And so the SJC completely botched it up, didn't talk about the right things. You've talked about some things that work in your favor, but maybe a court could say those still are not enough under a Barker, no thing is talismanic, all different parts are their own thing, and you have to do a balance. How do we, in this kind of case, say, that's it, it's unreasonable? One argument made is just like Doggett, that's one way to think about it. Is there another way to think about it?
Yes, Your Honor. We would certainly say that just under Barker, given the accurate analysis of the factors, no court could find that based on the accurate analysis of the factors, there was not a speedy
That's
trial.
That's how we would do it. We'd say these were the right things you should have considered.
Yes, I agree that under ADEPA, the test is not just did they get it wrong. It's did they get it wrong in such a way that the underlying determination that the speedy trial right was violated is incorrect. But that means you have to evaluate whether the speedy trial right was incorrect or not, and you have to evaluate how solid that determination is in terms of how arguable is it or is it not that speedy trial right is violated. And our argument is, when we discuss Barker, is that yes, it's clear going through these factors and determining them the way they should be determined that his speedy trial right was violated and no reasonable court would find otherwise.
So just to make sure I just follow that answer, at the end, what you're saying you do is, okay, each factor the SJC didn't calculate, didn't explain it correctly, all four of them, and then at the end you say, okay, here's how it should have been written, and then you get to the end and say, okay, is that a Barker violation or not? And then we have to say, on the correct understanding of what happened, could a court reasonably still have concluded it was not a Barker violation?
That's my understanding of the test. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, would counsel for the appellee please introduce herself on the record to begin?
Good morning, and may it please the court, Catherine Sherman on behalf of the respondent. As the court has correctly identified, the question here is whether or not the SJC reasonably applied Barker in this case, and it did. And even if this court finds error in its reasoning or might have looked at the factors differently, their ultimate conclusion in identifying, addressing, and analyzing the four Barker factors in their totality was a reasonable one. And in fact,
if they got them wrong, how can it be reasonable?
They did not get them wrong. The SJC's...
If we agree that they say we think that they got three out of the four wrong, then what?
Still, of the four factors, because no one factor is weighed differently than the others, and it is a fluid totality test, their conclusion that he was not denied his constitutional speedy trial right could and should still be found reasonable when given the double deference under habeas review and the speedy trial review of the state court's reasoning. And ultimately, this court...
measure that if we have these four standards that we say use this as a guide. So between Barker and Doggett, if we think that the SJC did them wrong, your argument is still that in the end, their conclusion was not unreasonable. It's like, what objectively do we look at if we decide they did it all wrong or most of it wrong?
Well, I think this court would be hard-pressed to come to that conclusion because of the record.
Well, before we do that, let's just get to the bottom of that, because I guess I wonder, is this right? What you do is you basically, let's say they got a lot wrong. Mm-hmm. You write it right. This is what it should have been. And then is it at the end you still say, okay, having written it right, at the bottom, could a court still have found no to the ultimate, this violates my speedy trial right? Is that?
That's correct. This court would have.
And how would you write that here? If you assume the SJC got all four of those wrong.
So the ultimate question would be that no reasonable jurist could come to the conclusion that his speedy trial rights were not violated. And that is
totally separate from their explanation as to why.
Yes. It can
be the right explanation.
Yes.
Still, some court, not the SJC, not this SJC, some hypothetical court could still rule against it.
Could, if I understand your question, yes, any court could review the factors, review the record, and say, this is how it should have been done, this is how we would have done it for each of the four factors. That said, their ultimate conclusion is not so unreasonable that no reasonable jurist could have found it. It would be that extreme malfunction of the system that habeas review requires to find that. And in this case where the state court findings are granted heightened deference and the SJC's analysis of the speedy trial rights receives the typical habeas deference, in that double deference context, that's an extreme conclusion to come to that is not supported by the record here. Beginning with the question that you all were...
Back to the same question. Is there a case you would point us to that goes through an analysis just like that? Like the state court got every single part of this issue wrong. Here's how it would be correct. Here's how we see it correctly. Yet still...
Unfortunately, off the top of my head, I can't think of a case where that level of... error has been found in a state speedy trial context. I think Rashad is helpful insofar as it recognizes the appeals court erred in their analysis of the time delay calculation. And notwithstanding that error, which they described as clear error, the rest of the reasoning held. And I think the Rashad opinion is helpful in terms of how the court really... affirmed on any grounds. They looked at the record, they saw what had been done wrong, yet found the reasonableness in the lower court's ruling.
For the AEDPA side, are there Barker cases where the court finds all factors point in favor of the defendant, but he still loses? Seems weird. You win. We have a four-factor test. Defendant wins on all four factors. But sorry, he still loses.
Because
one moment.
The problem, I know you're looking, but I mean, the problem is if he loses on all four, then I'm hung up on what objectively do we look to see that it was nonetheless unreasonable and that reasonable jurors wouldn't find it. Unreasonable.
Because of the...
I mean, I understand the double deference, mm-hmm. but it's got to be double deference to something that at least is correct?
Yes.
Or mostly correct?
And I suppose outside of the hypothetical context, this is not such a case. The SJC was correct in both the four factors that they analyzed, and they had strong support in the record for the conclusions that they came to on each of those four factors.
Maybe you should go through those.
I'd be happy to. Thank you. So beginning, the SJC summarizes their reasoning and their assessment of their totality test on page 72 of their opinion. They calculate the total delay of 9 years because they began the calculus at complaint, whereas here it's begun at indictment. That ultimately still translates to the federal assessment.
It's 7 years.
Yes, so 7 years. And that time is weighed against the Commonwealth, but is mitigated by Wallace's flight and the time spent in his federal trial during which the Commonwealth could not take him as a prisoner. The SJC is correct, again at 72, in finding that Wallace took no action consistent with asserting his speedy trial right.
There. So point one you just told me was he's responsible, but Rashad pretty much says we really should break that into two buckets.
Yes.
He's responsible for one part and not the other, and the SJC did not make that refinement. You agree with that? I think you have to, right?
Yes, I think that's correct.
Okay, so though an error there in overcounting his responsibility by not breaking it into two buckets.
They erred in that way when earlier in their opinion, they say 9 years are attributable to Wallace. That is error. However, at 72, when they actually do the totality balancing test, that is no longer their quantitative assessment of it.
7 years. The Commonwealth's not responsible for 7 years, but they are responsible. I'll give you the benefit of till his federal sentencing is done.
Yes.
They are responsible for the period from the federal sentencing forward, correct?
Yes.
Mr. Wallace is not responsible at all for that, correct?
That's correct.
They did not break apart and say there's a significant, a material chunk of this time for which Mr. Wallace is not responsible. Full responsibility rests with the Commonwealth for negligence.
That is where they land at page 72. They are saying Wallace bears, or his time in flight, which by their calculation is nearly half of it, mitigates the total delay in terms of the effect on prejudice.
It doesn't mitigate from the day of the federal sentencing forward.
That's correct.
And they don't make that distinction.
Yes, fair
that
enough.
Seems like an error.
It, insofar as they did not explicitly calculate out in that way, but it is not error when it's taken in the context of the full weight.
Yeah, let's stop there. So let's just call that as to factor one.
Yes.
Some portion of it is problematic. We just went through it. You have sort of an explanation, but you don't really say I'm completely wrong about that. Let's go to the second thing, because this is concerning to me, which is did he know he was indicted? What are his obligations to execute his speedy trial rights?
Yes, I will get to that. And actually, in regards to your first point, the SJC may not go through that calculation as explicitly as they might have or this court may have wanted them to, but they are adopting the motion judge's finding, and the motion judge does a much more explicit division of the time frames. And I believe that kind of adoption and incorporation of that ruling is consistent with here, where we're looking at 4 years, 2 months of time the Commonwealth is responsible for. And turning to your second point of that he took no action consistent with his speedy trial right, that is a fact supported by the record. Granted, the petitioner asks you to adopt this or to look at this as if he did not have notice of his indictment, he was not responsible for asserting his speedy trial rights. However, there is no case presented by the petitioner saying that notice of the indictment is necessary. He was aware, and it is not debated, that he was aware of that he was wanted for murder from the day that it happened and fled because of that. In fact, in the record, there is proof that he was aware of the murder indictment. This, I would point the court to the record at 42 and 809 to 810. The first is the First Circuit ruling in 2006, where it describes, I believe, part of his argument as arguing his classification was heightened but that was error because he was not yet indicted, indicating he has since been indicted. Similarly, at his 2007 sentencing rehearing, it's referenced as his indictment. He was also notified in 2005, the record at 507, detainer action letter, that was served on him, as noted at the bottom, that he was wanted out of two courts outstanding warrants, including one issued in 2002 for homicide. And separate and apart from whether or not he knew that he was wanted on an indictment, he knew he was wanted on murder. And that responsibility to assert his speedy trial right, had he done that in the state court any time after 2002, an indictment existed and he would have been held on that indictment and the speedy trial, federal and state rights would have triggered.
That's an odd way, though. I mean, you don't really have to throw yourself to the court. I mean, there's nothing, if he doesn't know he's indicted, there's really nothing there to bring him to trial. So, and the Commonwealth knows that it's indicted him. And so it yes. just seems an odd place. It's one thing if you know you're indicted and you're, but if you don't, it seems an odd place to place the blame on the person who may hope it goes away because they don't know they're indicted. Versus the entity that does know he's indicted, that has initiated the action and then doesn't do anything. That just seems odd.
And that said, there is, as reflected in Barker at 5:30, in a responsibility of some kind for the defendant to assert their right. As it says, a defendant's failure to assert the right will make it difficult for a defendant to prove that he was denied a speedy trial right. Additionally,
obligation to assert the right is nonetheless tied to when he's indicted.
So that said, he was indicted in state court, and I would say some of the federal cases in terms of looking at federal indictments, he had that state court indictment from 2002 onward. For the 2 years he was in flight after that point and the 5 years he was in custody after that point, had he chosen to or asked any of the numerous attorneys that represented him to look into the status of his murder case, that would have been discovered and he would have had.
That is on him. Like if you don't have actual knowledge of your indictment and you don't know there's a thing out there that actually allows the government to bring me to trial, I still have an obligation to ask for trial because they're looking into me?
No, he knew he was wanted for murder and that there were warrants for murder.
But at that point, let's agree with you, that's what he knew. Does he then have an obligation to assert
yes.
his...
It's not what entirely...
What are you basing that...
What should he... What are you saying specifically he should have done?
He could have written to a letter to the court. He could have asked any of his numerous federal attorneys to have acted on behalf. He could have...
You write a letter say, am I indicted?
He could have. But it would have had to ask for some sort of...
Because I guess what...
Brought to trial.
It's a right to speedy trial.
Yes.
So that means there's some legal mechanism out there to bring me to trial that I am asserting. A complaint and yes. a warrant are not those things. It's either an information for which you've waived grand jury or a grand jury indictment. And so until those things exist, there's nothing to bring me to trial. What trial right am I asserting?
Well, in Massachusetts, under the state law, he had the trial right beginning at complaint, and that would have invoked it and then simultaneously invoked the federal right. Additionally, there is evidence that not only could he and should he have known that his defense counsel in the federal cases were aware of the operation of the IED and likely aware of the impact of or could have found the indictment warrant on the May 27, 2007 hearing in the record at 796. His defense attorney is telling the court that if a detainer had been lodged, he would have availed himself on that right. That reflects a sophistication in the understanding between the comedy between the states and that attorney. Certainly could have figured that out for him. That said, this court, the lower court's finding, the motion judge's finding and the SJC's finding that he was aware and failed to assert, again, requires that double deference. And there is support in the record.
That is the First Circuit's opinion. That was one thing that he knew. So you could say, if that's a finding of the court, is that one we owe deference to? Does it have any support whatsoever? So one thing you said was the First Circuit's opinion.
Yes.
Made some reference to he wasn't indicted then, suggesting he is indicted now.
Yes.
What was the other thing you said?
He was served with a detainer action letter in 2005. That's in the record at 507.
You are wanted by this other court?
By two different courts, yes, for that.
Indicted for murder?
Yes, for homicide.
Because you're indicted?
That one has two different warrants for murder. It has a case number that reflects the Superior Court docket. Additionally, and importantly, it does not say indictment. That said, he's represented by counsel at this time in the federal proceedings, and that's something he could have sought assistance with.
Okay.
Also, at page 522 in the record, that's his notice of untried indictment form, which he refused to sign, and which was misinterpreted.
Oh, I'd say it's the untried indictment form. Is that what it says?
Yes, that's a notice of untried indictment. That served to him in 2009. He refuses to sign it. This, importantly, is the form that was misidentified by the magistrate and the lower federal court, but not by the SJC and the motion judge. He refused to sign a form that would have brought him to Massachusetts to be swiftly brought to trial on those charges. That is a clear indication of the conclusion that the court came to, that he did not want this murder trial to happen. He wanted to avoid being held accountable in Massachusetts, and he took no rights. He took no effort to assert his speedy trial rights in Massachusetts.
Before you sit down, we've sort of skipped reason for the delay, but I don't think we need to get into that. Can you discuss the prejudice prong?
Yes. So here, the SJC and the motion judge were correct in finding that he was entitled to presumptive prejudice, but that was it. He was denied any sort of weight for actual prejudice because he did not show that there was oppressive pretrial incarceration. He would have been incarcerated anyways, both being held on the federal case and serving his federal sentence.
He had a more onerous federal conditions because of the indictment?
So that was one of four errors in his prisoner calculation that were addressed during his resentencing. I would also draw...
I understand that answer. My question is, while he's in BOP custody, are his conditions more onerous than they otherwise would have been because he has an outstanding state indictment?
Yes, he was. There seemed to have been an adjustment in his security level because of that and other factors. But also on page 509 of the record, that's a request for reclassification. And it does not suggest that his security status is affected by the Massachusetts warrant. It's saying that it was being affected by a warrant out of New York that had been correctly dismissed for murder, out of Bronx, New York, that had nothing to do with the Massachusetts warrant. Additionally, that same form notes that he had violence in the prison at 2006. There were other factors affecting the state of, or his security level, and that was addressed and reduced for him. The anxiety and concern of the accused, the lower courts, and again, giving the double deference to them, found that anxiety and concern about his speedy trial rights weren't a significant prejudice factor.
We don't need to go to the ones they're not arguing.
Yes.
The one they are arguing is the fact that he lost the chance to face the parole board 4 years earlier than he otherwise would have.
And that is speculative.
Which part's speculative? That he would have had the chance or how they would have ruled?
How they would have ruled is, yes, that's fair.
You have to show there, though.
So
loss of chance seems to be some kind of prejudice.
That's talking about, well, his post-conviction sentencing structure, I detail it in the brief. I would suggest that had he been presented to the parole board earlier in time, he even could have been granted parole by the Massachusetts Parole Board and would not have left custody because of the timing of his much lengthier federal sentence. And the state court sentenced him concurrently with the federal sentence to two. So to the extent that there is any additional time spent in custody, that is not attributable to the pre-parole sentence in Massachusetts, which I believe was 10 years shorter than his federal sentence.
Has he been paroled from the state? Federal? No, right? He's not been paroled from the state.
Sentence. I don't believe so.
And so we don't know if he'll ever be paroled. I mean, he could have been paroled by the state 4 years earlier. He'd still be in federal custody. And then the federal custody is, you're saying it just wouldn't have mattered because?
Because he would have continued to be held in federal custody.
And at the end of the federal custody, he still, even under this problem, he still would have been able to go to the parole board at that point. And so really, what has he lost? If he's going to get parole in the federal, the state charge,
mm-hmm.
whether he could get it 4 years earlier, which wouldn't matter to him practically because he'll still be in jail. It's clear no matter what he could, even if you add 4 years at the end of the federal sentence, he could still ask for parole?
He may ask for parole, and I think the idea of a federally incarcerated
person. How much longer is the federal sentence than the?
I believe the federal sentence was 24 and a half years. The state minimum sentence is 15, and as Your Honor, or one of Your Honors pointed out earlier, it's a 15 to life. There is no end date to that state sentence. And in regards to that presumption of prejudice, because he did not prove the actual prejudice, the SJC correctly assessed that his flight lessened the weight of the prejudice against him when looked at in the totality. And that's supported by Rashad.
Your time, you're well over your time, so if you sum up.
If there are no further questions, the respondent rests on its brief. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, would counsel for the appellant please reintroduce himself on the record? He has a 2-minute rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. Charles Hope for Mr. Wallace. I'd like to start my rebuttal with reading from the last page of my reply brief that deference does not mean abdication, and deference does not, by definition, preclude relief. That was the Supreme Court on May 28th of this year in evaluating how a habeas petition should be evaluated. Briefly on the length of time issue and whether the alleged 4 years compared to the alleged 4 years by the Commonwealth mitigates the delay somehow, as the magistrate judge correctly points out, the magistrate judge in the district court here correctly points out under that reason.
Your strongest point, but let's talk about maybe the weaker point, which is it seems like there is some record evidence that he was new or had reason to know he was indicted and did not act. I mean, is there a form that's in 2009 that says untried indictment and he said it doesn't sign it?
2009, Your Honor, is the year in which he's brought in for arraignment. And the form says, do you waive your extradition rights so that he can be brought to, it was given to him after the state court had requested the detainer, presented to him saying, do you waive your extradition rights so that you can be brought to state court for trial?
Circuit opinion says you weren't indicted then, suggesting you're indicted now.
He was indicted in 2009. He was clearly put on notice at that point, but that was...
The SJC opinion's the First Circuit opinion is earlier than that.
The First Circuit opinion is wrong, Your Honor. As I point out in my brief, the First Circuit opinion says he was indicted at the time of the robbery in Rhode Island, and the First Circuit corrected itself in the second sentence saying, no, he wasn't indicted at that time. So, yes, there are incorrect statements as to when he was indicted in that, but there aren't any correct ones. I would also just quickly like to say, compare the assertion of right prong in Barker to the assertion of right here. In Barker, the assertion of right was found was the deciding factor because, represented by counsel, Mr. Barker had repeatedly agreed to continuances in the state court. That is not the situation here. The Commonwealth is trying to argue that an unrepresented defendant failing to bring something without even a pending court hearing for him to bring it in is to be held against him in a way that is just not comparable to what was going on in Barker.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes argument in this case.